They're very hard to avoid. Every month, about 19 million Australians search the internet using Google, and 17 million of us access Facebook. And what these two tech giants know about us, most of us wouldn't want our closest friends to have access to.
Google and Facebook are hoovering away over $4 billion in advertising revenue in this country every year. Of course, that will have a profound impact on journalism in this country.
When you get to a certain stage and you get market power, which both Google and Facebook have, with that comes special responsibilities. And that means also additional scrutiny.
This week, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission released its preliminary report into digital platforms and said Google and Facebook had dominated and distorted the advertising market and were adversely impacting news publishers. The digital giants' influence on democracy is incalculable, but it's their handling of personal information that has made the regulator nervous.
There seems an understatement to consumers of the extent of data collection, if you read the policies, and an overstatement to consumers of the level of control consumers have over their personal data use.
As Facebook and Google scramble to respond, tough new recommendations over privacy and data collection will have global ramifications and are designed to limit their market dominance. The rest of the world is watching, and ACCC Chief Rod Sims hopes his report is just the beginning of an international response to the rise of the search and social behemoths.
That they have significantly disrupted media and journalism and their business models.
So what does it mean for you? From the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, this is Please Explain, a weekly podcast where you and I get the full story on some of the most significant issues facing Australia and a look inside the newsrooms that bring them to you. I'm Tori Maguire. Today I'm joined by two reporters from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age who specialise in the media and tech space, John McDooling and Jennifer Duke. Welcome, John and Jen.
Hi.
Hi, Tori.
Later in the podcast, John interviews ACCC boss Rod Sims about his world-leading report. Then for a change of pace, we'll be taking you to the Middle East to catch up with world editor Michael Bachelard and photographer Kate Geraghty while they're on assignment. But back to Facebook and Google. And two things you should know before we start. The Sydney Morning Herald and The Age have a significant advertising deal with Google. And also, we made a submission to the Sims Inquiry that led to the preliminary report. So we've got skin in the game. But very likely so do you. John, I'm going to go to you first. What is the background to this report? How did this inquiry come about?
So it came about a year ago in 2017 when the federal parliament was negotiating changes to cross-media ownership laws. It was actually the Centrist Alliance, which at the time was led by Nick Xenophon. In order for them to support the repeal of that legislation, they secured this review into Google and Facebook's dominance in the media market. Now, traditional media companies, most prominently News Corp, but also Fairfax Media and the TV companies have been sort of complaining or raising the issue of the dominance of Google and Facebook in the advertising market for years. This was probably the first attempt by an independent global regulator to sort of scrutinize that and examine that. The other thing I would note is that this inquiry took place against the backdrop of growing global concerns about Google and Facebook. There have been a number of sort of global scandals involving both companies relating to privacy and fake news and issues along those lines, most prominently Facebook, the Cambridge Analytica scandal where millions of Facebook users had their data harvested without them knowing it. It's become a big political issue in the US because both platforms are also have admitted that they were manipulated by Russian troll groups during the 2016 elections in the US, which, as we all know, saw the election of Donald Trump to the White House.
So this is a preliminary report. No doubt the Google and Facebook and the big publishers will all respond. And the world is watching very closely because, as you say, it's the first time this has been examined. Jen, how far did Rod Sims go in his recommendations on curbing Facebook and Google?
I think that most people were quite impressed with what he put up. He suggested things like an ombudsman, a regulatory authority to keep an eye on their algorithms, He also went so far as to suggest rules akin to the GDPR arrangements in Europe, which would be around people's data controls that they have over their own information online. Most people seem to think that he's been pretty toothy with his decisions. Facebook and Google will probably fight what's been recommended quite hard. In particular, there's a recommendation that they might have to tell regulators ahead of time in Australia about any acquisitions that would be significant. It could be things like the next Instagram or WhatsApp.
Before they've made it.
Yes, and it's not likely that that's going to go down super well over at Facebook HQ.
So for users, there were two things that I thought were really interesting. One is this idea that you need to opt in to them collecting your data. How does it work at the moment? I mean, I use Facebook, but I don't pay any attention to how it operates. I try not to use it too much. I've probably signed away my whole life, have I?
Well, at the moment, if you go on there and you start filling in categories, it's very much an opt-out situation. So since the Cambridge Analytica scandal, there's been an awful lot of changes around how you can manage your data. And there are ways that you can sort of opt out of certain categories and say, I don't want ad targeting based on these factors, delete aspects of your life off of there. And they do promise that they'll clear things up. What the regulator wants to do is make that more of an opt-in process so that you would have to knowingly say, yes, I want them to be able to target me based on these factors, as opposed to the other way around.
And presumably they'd have to be clear, because the T's and C's, I think they found it could take a normal person 10 to 20 minutes when they sign up to something.
There's
like
that much time.
And also the understanding. But would it be as simple as something pops up saying, do you give us permission to take your data? And you have to say, sure.
I think that remains to be seen. But I just think that we can't avoid the reality that both of these companies' business models depend on extracting as much data out of users as possible.
And some people are very comfortable with that, and that's the point. It should be about choice, and it should be about saying, if you get good utility from using the service by providing that data and you're okay with that, you should still be able to do that. It's just that everyone else who perhaps wants the benefit of using it but doesn't want them knowing their grandfather's, mother's, son's, child's name, you should be able to have that option. It is a clarity issue, and I think that there aren't that many companies doing a really great job at telling you everything you need to know quickly. And I'm not sure that that is all that doable. I mean, there's so many different ways that they can collect your data that it must take quite a while to read through just an explanation of that. So I don't know what that smoking gun looks like.
The other thing I thought was interesting is some kind of examination or oversight of the algorithms themselves. John, how would you even do that? I mean, there's all these theories about Google that somehow its algorithm is ideological. I know that there are some very senior people in the Australian media who think that Google's algorithm is designed to downplay conservative voices. That's a pretty out there opinion. But how do you actually examine how an algorithm that complicated works?
It's a very good question, and it's one that no one really has a good answer to at this stage. I don't think even sort of the ACCC explained it that well. I know News Corporation globally has been campaigning really strongly for this concept of an algorithm regulator. It just seems, you know, some figures in the tech community have pushed back against this idea because it just seems like a kind of unusual intrusion into the way these companies operate, as valid as the concerns are about their dominant position and the nature of their businesses, the targeting involved and the, you know, potential privacy issues that results in. It's just a little bit weird. It's just a little bit like having a regulator that decides our news list or something along those lines. And I think we can be pretty sure that, yeah, this scariness around the algorithms is something that Google and Facebook are certainly going to push back against. The complexity involved in deciding what you see after a Google search or what appears in your Facebook feed is kind of intrinsic to their businesses, but it's also something that I can't imagine an external government body is going to be able to manage.
Yeah, I mean, there's thousands of iterations as to how every person's page is personalised. And if you imagine that across Australia and across the world, it's hard to figure out how many people they'd need to just sit there and comb through these things.
Yeah. Well, I know in Facebook, the way the news feed works in Facebook and how it surfaces content, it makes more than 300,000 judgments on data points about every single thing that it puts into your feed. So
that's mammoth.
It's hard to comprehend.
Yeah.
So therefore incredibly hard to examine. On the issue of news and the business model for news, the vast majority of new advertising dollars in digital go to Facebook and Google.
Mm-hmm.
Was that that's not a technical issue. That's just a reality of the sales market in Australia. Was there any examination of that in this report that is going to satisfy the news companies that are all, including us, who are trying to, you know, keep these mastheads afloat with digital advertising?
So the ACCC found that I think of every $100 in digital advertising spending in Australia, I think $68 flows to Google and Facebook. The rest is split.
We're fighting out amongst the rest of us are fighting amongst ourselves for it.
So how does that compare to, I mean, we've had oligopoly-like positions in media in the past, the TV market in previous eras, but there's all sorts of oligopolies across the Australian economy. I think the distinction that the ACCC made, which will please the media industry, is that media companies provide a public good, which is traditional journalism, which has, you know, a value to society, holding power to account, uncovering things that otherwise wouldn't be uncovered. Which is, for them to come out and say that is pretty significant. And, you know, in a previous era, before Google and Facebook, the advertising industry underpinned all sorts of, you know, content and journalism out there, not just, you know, investigative journalism, but also sort of like dramatic content. Now a lot of that money is flowing to Google and Facebook, who have separately been accused of not paying any tax in Australia and that type of thing. So for the ACCC to sort of make that distinction around journalism being a public good, something that may have been forgotten in the sort of the past decade or so with the rise of the digital giants, but for them to come out and say that and come up with some solutions such as personal tax deductions for subscriptions to newspapers, I think is pretty significant.
And I think that the ACCC, in a practical sense, just saying that they're going to provide some oversight as to the prices charged by the digital platforms on ads, and to then force them to be accountable, to perhaps have some sort of measurement as to how much reach there is over an ad. I mean, that's been, a topic of resentment among publishers for a long, long time, that they have to provide circulation figures and kind of prove their case, and then other digital giants can just flow in and say, actually, well, we've got a massive reach. Then they find out that it's the numbers they're providing. And that's been a massive issue. So even just that admission is quite substantial.
So some mastheads, including the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, are focusing more on subscriptions instead of advertising. We still, we do have a deal with Google for advertising, so we've sort of got a hybrid model, whereas newspapers like The Australian and some of the other News Corp mastheads have gone completely all boots in and all on subscriptions. As far as a strategy goes, is that going to put them in a better position than mastheads that are just all about reach, who are just basically providing the same service as Google and Facebook, which is ad impressions?
I mean, the question has to be, does the advertising model work for publishers if Google and Facebook are actually doing it better? And I think this is the big elephant in the room, is that maybe they're doing so well just because they managed to get more people to look at the ads and more people to click on them, and because there's no restraints over what they can put on there. So they can have some massive clickbait thing about spa baths next to a spa bath ad, and you'd never see something like that on the Herald.
And they can target those ads to individuals, can't they?
I mean, of course you can get a paper that can do much better targeting. Obviously it's part of the Nine Fairfax strategy. I think there's even that arrangement with News Corp to share some audience data to track people. But at the same time, if you're not of the size of a Facebook, you're never going to be able to do it in that way. So perhaps the subscription model just makes an awful lot more sense, because that plays to the strengths of newspapers, which is loyalty from your audience.
Yeah, no matter what traditional media companies say, they're never going to win a battle with Google and Facebook when it comes to targeting. If you think of the level of information that people willfully hand over to Facebook about themselves and their lives, it's going to be very hard for any sort of traditional publisher to compete with that. And the subscription model seems to be working for some.
But where we can win is on trust and loyalty and engagement.
That's right. And the sort of the core strengths of the time-honoured traditions and the time-tested values of breaking news and you know, seeking the truth.
Fact-checking.
I'll look at us, but I'm so global.
It's a love-in.
So what is the next step? This is an interim report, preliminary report.
preliminary.
Yeah, there's another 6 months or so. I think it's June next year, a final report is
due. So they, Facebook and Google and the publishers have until February to put in new submissions based on the recommendations that have been made. There'll probably be a lot of fighting over which ones are valid. My understanding this early is that the privacy arrangements, everyone seems to okay with them because they're quite similar to overseas things that are already sort of in place. There's been a lot of changes on Facebook and Google already this year, so most of that stuff's like already done. But the other ombudsman suggestions like that will probably be fought over, and then after they have February to June to kind of make some final decisions.
Presumably, we'll have a federal election in between now and then.
We may have a new government.
But no one seems to think it's going to affect this process at all. There seems to be pretty broad
agreement,
bipartisan support across the parliament for some type of regulation of Google and Facebook, and there doesn't seem to be much of a constituency in parliament to kind of stand up and support them, because why would you? There doesn't seem to be a lot of political sense in saying, hey, we think Google and Facebook should be even more powerful. So it seems as though whatever the ACCC ends up deciding and recommending will end up getting through parliament.
So just finally, how is this going to work when these two companies are not based here? We're a very small part of their audience. Is it possible that Australian rules are going to force these global companies to make global changes, or are they going to try and quarantine this around this tiny market?
We always think we're more important than we are, but I think there is a lot of talk, though, that what Rod Sims decides to do will be looked at by America in particular, and the UK has clearly made steps to say that they're interested in making additional changes. And of course, anyone that does anything towards companies like Google and Facebook, that's significant on a global scale.
Yes, there is a lot of interest in this review globally. And I think both of the digital giants are kind of, there's a sense that they're a little bit nervous about this creating a precedent that is adopted globally. Rod Sims is openly talking about trying to kind of get a bit of momentum behind what he's suggested, and you know, getting the regulators in the US and Europe to kind of follow his lead. I think this concept of an algorithm regulator or a regulator to examine the way these digital giants send publishers traffic and also their conduct in the advertising market, I think the ACCC itself is hinting that that could actually be a global body if other countries get on board with it, which would be a pretty significant development. And, you know, Rod Sims is obviously hoping that he can generate enough interest and enough support from other regulators and other bigger countries for that to happen.
All right, well, we're about to hear your conversation with Rod Sims now. Thanks, John. Thanks, Jen.
Thanks.
Thank you. We have the ACCC chair, Rod Sims, here with us this afternoon. Rod, you've spent the past year investigating Google and Facebook, their role in the modern digital advertising landscape and their impact on traditional media. What did you find?
We found, firstly, that the digital platforms have completely disrupted traditional media, partly because they take away the brand recognition that goes with traditional media stories, because most people are getting those stories through Facebook and Google and not quite sure where they're coming from. We found that often media content can get top or tailed, and so the people who did all the work and put all the expense into producing the story don't get credit for it. So very hard for the media these days to earn money from the content they produce. So that was one important finding. Secondly, we found that the digital platforms have both the ability and the incentive to discriminate against other businesses and favour their own businesses, and that is very hard to work out whether or not that's happening, because it's often done through algorithms that are pretty hard to get to the bottom of. And thirdly, we found that there were privacy issues and potentially issues where consumers are misled or perhaps don't fully understand what's going on. For example, we would argue consumers underestimate how much of their data is being collected from them and probably overestimate how much control they have to deal with that.
You've made a string of recommendations on how to deal with this situation, the market power that Google and Facebook control and the way they exercise that market power. How will these suggestions that you've made, how will they change things for people who use these services?
We're suggesting that a regulator look at the algorithms, both the inputs to them and the outputs from them, in terms of how they rank advertising. That way they'll be able to see whether they're favouring their own businesses, see how stories are ranked, see how consumers are getting their information, and be able to let the world know that, and governments can know that as well and see whether there's anything they should be doing. But that transparency will help a lot. Also, changing privacy laws and related laws to give consumers more control over how their data is used, what of their data is captured, and what they can opt out of, what data they can have erased, just give the consumers a lot more control. So recommendations like that will go a long way to consumers feeling they're more in charge here rather than having to do whatever the platform wants them to do.
Is there any risk that if these recommendations are adopted that it creates a different internet in Australia, and do the suggestions that you've made need to be adopted globally for these companies to be regulated properly?
I think there's much that the Australian government can do. There's also much that the ACCC can do. We've got five investigations underway looking at whether breaches of the Act have occurred. But the Australian government can act. They are both Facebook and Google doing business in Australia, therefore they're caught by the reach of Australian laws. But of course, the more things are done internationally, the better. And I think our report is extremely timely. Governments overseas are looking at Facebook and Google. We, I think, have come up with information that others haven't had. So this will, our report, I think, will feed into that international discussion of these issues. And we're very well connected with all our international counterparts. So I think there'll be things the government can do initially, but I think this will play out over time as well. So it's a bit of a beginning of a journey trying to rebalance the rights of consumers vis-a-vis the market power of Facebook and Google.
Is it a problem in itself that Google and Facebook have so much market power, or is it how they use that market power?
It's a bit of both. Their business system is based on gathering data. I mean, they're very commercially focused, profit-driven companies, both of them, and their business model is based on getting your data. They get your data, they sell that to advertisers to target ads to you, and while you're on the platform, the more ads you can receive. So that's what they want, that's their business system. Now, when they're small, that doesn't really matter that much. There's a lot of other players out there. When they're as big as they are, and everybody, well, a lot of people feel they must use them, they've got no alternative, that's when just the normal business system can do harm that wasn't done when they're a lot smaller. So I think it's just their whole business system and the way it works when Google and Facebook are so ubiquitous, so everywhere, that's really the problem. I'm not suggesting it's an issue with Facebook and Google necessarily going out of their way to misbehave. It's just their business system operating on such a pervasive scale.
How does their strong market position, the strong market position of Google and Facebook, and concerns about privacy, aren't they two separate issues? How do they interrelate?
Oh, they're part of the one issue. You can't separate privacy from looking at Google and Facebook. Their business system is gathering data about you, and they do that in many more ways than you think. They have agreements with a lot of other websites and apps to get data from those apps, so they're getting data from you when you're not on their sites. They're getting data on you in terms of location, likes, dislikes. This can evolve to them working out and telling the advertiser how much you're willing to pay for a particular good. This is very persuasive and pervasive. It's the consumer's right to privacy and right to control the information that others have on them is at the core of this issue. You just cannot take the privacy angle out of looking at Facebook and Google. If you do that, you're missing half the story. It's an interrelated story.
Rod Sims, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Jess Irvine. Thanks for listening to Please Explain. The Sydney Morning Herald and Age newsrooms are home to the country's most experienced economics editors and reporters, delivering trusted news and analysis. But we can't do it without you. Our subscribers get unlimited access to our award-winning independent journalism, plus exclusive behind-the-scenes stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe today and support news you can trust.
Welcome back. The millions of Syrians who have fled their country since the war began in 2011 have bent international politics out of shape. Their exodus has moved some and terrified others, emboldening anti-immigration parties and driving the resurgence of right-wing politics throughout Europe. But what's happened to those who fled? Where are they now? Michael Bachelard is the foreign editor of the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age. We caught him and photographer Kate Geraghty in an airport in Amman, Jordan, while on assignment covering those trapped outside of a home they can't or won't return to.
I'm sitting in a coffee shop at Amman Airport in Jordan on the way out to Istanbul. Thank you. We spent the past week or so in refugee camps largely, first in Lebanon, where the situation is absolutely fascinating for the Syrian refugees who fled the war over the past decade. And we've spent in refugee camps talking to refugees living in urban environments in Jordan. The picture's quite different in the two countries, despite the fact that both of them have taken really very large numbers of refugees from this conflict. The camps in Lebanon vary greatly. Some of the ones we went to, the conditions were absolutely terrible. They are in rural areas. We went up north to the Bekaa Valley near the Syrian border. They were their tents or very flimsy structures made of wood and canvas. Some of them aren't even waterproof. Winter's on the way and it gets pretty cold up there, so people are worried about how they're going to survive the winter. There are a lot of NGOs and aid agencies working, and so we were there, for example, with Oxfam, who's providing water. But the Lebanese government is extremely concerned about any hint of permanency. They don't want any idea that these people will stay more than is absolutely necessary. And so even pouring a concrete slab to on the ground to try and, you know, provide a bit of insulation during winter and waterproofing is something that the Lebanese government really doesn't want to happen. So the settlements there, certainly the ones we saw, are very flimsy and very temporary looking. In Lebanon, Turkey and Jordan, we're talking 5 million odd people who have fled the conflict. You know, compared to the 12,000 special humanitarian intake that Australia took, these relatively poor countries in the region have taken a vast, vast majority of the displaced people from the Syrian conflict. There is a push, certainly in Lebanon, to try and get people to return, and less so in Jordan. People are feeling a bit more comfortable and settled here, but they are feeling the push from the Lebanese government and from Lebanese society, but they're not really ready. The cities have been flattened very often, their homes are gone, there's not much in the way of livelihoods, there's still conflict raging, certainly in parts of Syria, and a really dire security situation in other parts. So there is starting to become quite a bit of pressure between the desire of regional governments to have them go home and the kind of fear of people in these camps that the country's not ready to have them.
So if running water and insulation is a challenge, what about things like education? I mean, there'd be kids being born into families in these camps. What hope have they got in their current situation?
Anybody under about seven has probably been born in the camp and knows no other life. But that schooling stops at high school, and so we met a boy, 16-year-old boy yesterday, who hasn't been to school since he was 11, and all he's doing is hanging around and playing football. So, you know, that's really not preparing him for a future. In Lebanon, some of the kids are going to schools, they're going in the afternoon. So the local kids go in the morning to the schools, and then they all go off home, and the refugee kids come in. But again, it's pretty patchy, and there are a lot of kids missing out.
So the people that you've met in these camps, are they telling you that they would like to go home, or are they telling you that they'd like to go elsewhere, like Australia, for instance?
In the Lebanese camps, we found on the whole people didn't want to go home. They liked their home, but, you know, as patriotic people do, but they were scared of the conflict, and they were scared actually of the regime, the Assad regime, which has survived this war, and what will happen to them. They fear arrest, they fear that their men and boys will be conscripted into the military, and some of them fear that they may be on this the infamous list of people who are kind of black banned and will be imprisoned. So they're not very enthusiastic about going home. In Jordan, we did meet people who were keen actually yesterday as soon as possible, but they say it's not yet possible. Others who are looking for resettlement in third countries. We haven't met many looking to Australia, but quite a few are looking to Europe, and many already have families in Europe, some of whom went in that sort of great exodus to Europe in 2014 and 2015.
How important is it, Batch, for people like you and Kate to go and cover these stories? I mean, there's journalists crawling all over the Middle East. Why is it important that reporters and journalists and photographers from the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age go and do these stories?
Well, nobody else is going to go to a camp, you know, in Syria or Jordan and ask about resettlement in Australia. Nobody else is going to say to them, did you meet Neil Prakash or Khalid Sharif or any of the other Australian foreign fighters? Nobody's going to look for the wives and children of foreign fighters. Now, we're not saying we're going to find those people or that we're going to get answers to those questions, but nobody's going to be even there to ask the questions unless we do it. And plus, I think there's a way of viewing the world, a way of explaining the world to Australians that Australians are best placed to do. We rely on, very largely on wire services and international newspapers to cover the basic news for us. But telling those Australian stories in that Australian voice, with our correspondents and our kind of, more sort of ad hoc trips like this one, I think are crucially important.
Michael, thanks for joining us. You and Kate take care and best of luck.
Good on you. Thanks, Tori.
Michael and Kate's in-depth report will be running in the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age soon. Thanks to our guests this episode, Jennifer Duke, John McDooling, Rod Sims, Michael Bachelard and Kate Geraghty. If you know someone who should be listening to Please Explain, let them know about us. If they're not a podcast listener yet, grab their phone and get them subscribed for weekly episodes. Please Explain is brought to you by the newsrooms of The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Subscribing to our news service gets you unlimited access to award-winning, independent journalism and great behind-the-scenes content you can't get anywhere else. Follow the link in our show bio to get a subscription today. This episode was produced and edited by David Escort and Nicole Priestell, technical assistance from David McMillan, and Tom McKendrick is our head of audio. I'm Tori Maguire. Thanks for listening.